Welcome to Between the Lines, presenting news and analysis of critical issues affecting our region, the nation, and the world. This week we present Aran Keshavarzian, Assistant Professor of Government at Connecticut College, who examines the likelihood that the Bush administration is contemplating a military strike on Iran's nuclear infrastructure in the event that diplomacy fails. Author and environmentalist Bill McKibben, who talks about a five-day walk across Vermont on Labor Day, he organized to demand that politicians respond to the urgent issue of global warming. And Sarah Anderson, a fellow at the Institute for Policy Studies and co-author of a CEO wage survey, who discusses the exponential increase in pay to corporate executives in the oil and defense industries. But first, we begin with a summary of some of the week's underreported news stories.
Eating organic is about chemical-free food that is healthy for consumers and the environment. Yet fair wages and benefits for farm workers are not part of the promise of sustainable agriculture. For example, organic raspberry picker Elena Ortiz makes only $500 a week during peak harvest season and $200 a week during the rest of the year. The wage rates are similar to those working in conventional agriculture. Moreover, few organic farms are unionized or feel the pressure from upscale consumers to improve working conditions for farm workers. As organic farm owner Jim Cochran observed, everybody cares about how the bugs are treated, but no one really cares how the workers are treated. According to The Grist, an online environmental magazine, a study by Human Rights Watch and the University of California, Davis, concluded most organic farms in California do not pay a living wage or provide medical or retirement benefits. Organic food is now a $14 billion industry and growing rapidly, with Walmart and General Mills making inroads into the natural food market. A few organic farms have decided to pay a living wage to farm workers. Swanton Berry Farm was the first organic farm to sign a contract with the United Farm Workers. Today, its farm workers make upward of $11 an hour and are offered health insurance and pension benefits. During the early 1990s, Janice Elspas underwent in vitro fertilization treatment to become pregnant. She gave birth to four children. After her pregnancy, she had 14 embryos left, which remain in a nitrogen storage facility. Elspas, a media relations executive, is ambivalent about her embryos. She could give them to another family, donate them for research, or leave them frozen. As she told Mother Jones magazine, "I don't have the heart to thaw them, but then again, I don't have the heart to do something with them." The mother of four teenagers is not alone. According to estimates, over 400,000 frozen embryos sit in nearly 500 fertility centers. The majority of these embryos are routinely destroyed. The growing number of IVF embryos is now at center stage in the battle over stem cell research. In vetoing a bill to expand stem cell research, President George Bush surrounded himself with so-called snowflake babies, children born utilizing unused IVF embryos. Conservative groups have gone to court to get special legal status for the frozen embryos. In Louisiana, courts have given the embryos the status of judicial person, a confusing term. The status gives Louisiana courts the power to stop fertility clinics from disposing of embryos and to act in the embryo's best interest. The Bush administration is now providing grants to groups raising public awareness of embryo adoption. The next presidential election is more than 2 years away, and the mainstream media is already examining the status of Hillary Clinton's marriage. In a long front-page feature, the New York Times dissected Hillary and Bill Clinton's apparently separate lives, noting the power couple only spend 14 days a month together. The Washington Monthly magazine notes this is hardly surprising since Hillary is a prominent Democratic U.S. senator and Bill Clinton is a globetrotting ex-president. The national media ought to have even more fun delving into the confessed infidelity of three leading Republican contenders for president, John McCain, Rudy Giuliani, and Newt Gingrich. All three have had affairs and divorces that could upset conservative Republican primary voters. During the 2000 GOP primaries, Dr. James Dobson, president of Focus on the Family, issued a press release attacking McCain for being involved with another woman while he was married to his first wife. Giuliani and Gingrich have long trails of infidelity. Giuliani, who is politically exploiting his fame from the 9/11 attacks, has divorced twice. The second divorce was bitter, as the New York City mayor publicly courted another woman while he was still married to Donna Hanover, a local TV anchor, who accused America's mayor of being a serial adulterer. Gingrich, the former House Speaker, had his second divorce in 1999 after getting caught in an affair with a 33-year-old congressional aide. This happened a year after Gingrich pushed for the impeachment of Bill Clinton. At the moment, all the Democratic presidential hopefuls for 2008 are free of any sexual scandals. However, the mainstream media has shown little appetite for exposing likely GOP candidates' infidelities. This week's news summary was compiled by Bob Nixon. For Between the Lines, I'm Bill Cosentino.
Iran, having defied a UN Security Council deadline of August 31st to suspend its enrichment of uranium, is now facing possible economic sanctions. The Bush administration, declaring it will stand in the way of what it claims are Iranian efforts to develop nuclear weapons, has expressed doubts that a final effort at talks between Tehran and the European Union will halt Iran's uranium enrichment program. Iran denies that it is working to develop nuclear weapons and claims its research is focused solely on building civilian atomic power technology. Iran insists that as a signatory of the Nuclear Non-Proliferation Treaty, it has the right to convert and enrich uranium for peaceful purposes. But Washington contends that Iran forfeited that right when Tehran admitted that it had deceived inspectors of the International Atomic Energy Agency for some 17 years. Iran did not respond positively to a package of economic and diplomatic incentives offered by members of the UN Security Council in June in exchange for a halt to its uranium enrichment operation. The Iranian government may feel that it can evade sanctions due to the lucrative economic ties it has with Russia and China, both veto-wielding members of the Security Council. Between the Lines, Scott Harris spoke with Arang Keshavarzian, assistant professor of government at Connecticut College and an editor at Middle East Report, who examines the likelihood that the Bush administration is contemplating a military strike on Iran's nuclear infrastructure in the event that diplomacy fails to resolve the standoff.
The prospects for economic sanctions are real. However, it's unlikely that the Chinese and the Russian governments that are so closely wedded to the Iranian economy, China is the second largest exporter to Iran. It has major gas and oil contracts with Iran. It's unlikely that China would side with any drastic set of sanctions. And Germany is the number one exporter to Iran. So many of the European powers, Germany, Italy, France, and England, also would be hesitant to impose such radical sanctions because many of their business interests are obviously not interested in that. And also from the U.S. point of view, imposing radical sanctions on Iran will automatically drive up the price of oil and will have consequences for the U.S.'s domestic economy. So I suspect that we're not going to see anything too drastic in the form of sanctions. As far as military strikes, I think I've always thought that in the back of the neoconservatives' minds, the ideal scenario would be to go in and strategically strike certain locations in Iran. And I think the scenario would be once you strike those locations, the Iranian people, this Iranian youth that they keep talking about will take to the street and automatically, in a sense, mechanistically overthrow the Islamic Republic. This would be the kind of the dream scenario. However, this scenario is highly unlikely given that Iranian society is very fragmented. It lacks the social and political organizations to actually take to the streets in that matter. And also, there is a sense of nationalism in Iran, which is very strong. And just as rallying around the flag kind of theme is strong in U.S. society and U.S. culture, it's also an important part of Iranian culture. And you will see a kind of rallying around the flag scenario if the U.S. does strike. On the technical matter, which I'm not by no means an expert on, from what I understand, it will be extremely difficult for the U.S. to take out all of Iran's nuclear sites. Because Iran is so large and these sites are really, very dispersed, and also because Iran has learned from Iraq's experience when the Israeli Air Force went in and bombed out its nuclear facilities. And these nuclear facilities, from what I understand, are very carefully planned, are hidden. And we must remember that the U.S. doesn't have any intelligence assets in Iran, as far as I understand. It has very poor intelligence information on Iran, and what it does have is very much like the Iraqi case, is a set of Iranian expats that are feeding their administration information, and it sounds like much of it is highly suspect. And members of the intelligence community in the U.S. that have been on the fly for the past 3-4 years are quite aware that they have to be careful consumers of this information that's been given to them by monarchists and various other opposition groups based in the U.S. and in Europe.
What is the likelihood, do you think, of a U.S. attack on Iran's nuclear facilities?
I would like to think it's very unlikely, but that may be being slightly optimistic here, because I do feel that it would be a catastrophe for the U.S., for Iran and Iranians, and the entire Middle East region if the U.S. does attack Iran. It will not be a simple scenario such as the Iraqi case. You must remember, the Iraqi government was under sanctions for 12 years before the war. The Iranian government is not to overestimate its military might, but nonetheless, it's fairly well equipped. It has a ideologically robust core of supporters who believe in the revolution, believe in the leadership. They are well organized, and it shows that, you know, they've nurtured Hezbollah for all these years, specifically for this very reason, as a form of deterrent against Israeli or U.S. attack. And given that Hezbollah performed fairly well in the recent war between Israel and Lebanon, that deterrent may actually have worked. I would imagine it gave a number of Israeli and U.S. officials second thoughts about attacking Iran at this point, given that Hezbollah, on the last day of that 3-4 week war, was still able to launch many rockets into Israel.
If you could address high officials in the U.S. State Department and suggest a more pragmatic or a more successful policy towards Iran, what would that be?
I would say that the U.S. has very little leverage with Iran at this particular point, and things have only gotten worse since the events of the summer. So the United States really has very little choice but to sit down and negotiate with Iran, but it should not just negotiate over the nuclear issue. There are a whole host of issues and points of contention between the two countries, whether it's Iraq, whether it's Afghanistan, whether it's oil policy, long-standing economic grievances going back to the hostage crisis. All of these issues could be brought to the table and negotiated in different ways. And I think that's one way for the U.S. to, in a sense, give Iran the Islamic Republic certain issues, but fight for other issues. At this point, I don't see the U.S. being able to single-handedly bully Iran one way or another. So Iran really is many years away from, you know, acquiring the bomb or acquiring the ability to have the bomb. What is more worrying is an Islamic Republic that continues to be belligerent vis-a-vis its own population, vis-a-vis its own citizens, and able to use these international crises to prolong violations of human rights. But to me, that's the larger concern.
That was Arang Keshavarzian, assistant professor of government at Connecticut College and an editor at Middle East Report. Read his articles online at www.marip.org. Professor Keshavarzian is the author of the forthcoming book, Bazaar and the State in Iran. Environmentalist and author Bill McKibben wrote The End of Nature in 1984, the first book about global warming for a popular audience. He's been working ever since to raise awareness of the issue, as greenhouse gas emissions have increased exponentially over the past 2 decades, and virtually no action has been taken by Washington to address the problem. Where Washington has failed, cities and states have taken the initiative to cut back emissions from fossil fuels, promote energy conservation, and increase the use of renewable energy. In that vein, McKibben organized a 5-day walk across Vermont that spanned the Labor Day weekend. The walk was a call to make global warming the key issue politicians must respond to. And respond they did. At the closing rally in Burlington, every politician running for federal office, Democrat, Republican, and Independent Congressman Bernie Sanders, signed onto a pledge to support the ambitious global warming bill sponsored by outgoing Vermont Independent Senator Jim Jeffords. Vermont, like everywhere else, is suffering impacts from global warming that are changing the very nature of the state, and the issue has become a critical one for many of the state's residents and voters. Between the Lines, Melinda Tuhu spoke with Bill McKibben after the first mass action and rally, which focused totally on global warming. He discusses the urgent need to address global climate change and what he hopes this walk will accomplish.
We were very happy this year that in the House, Henry Waxman introduced a strong bill and Jim Jeffords, a companion in the Senate. You know, neither one of them could get past the leadership at the moment of either the Democratic or Republican leadership in the House or the Senate. So we have to build real support for this legislation, and that's now what we've done in Vermont. It's very clear that both Republican and Democratic candidates for federal office in Vermont understand that they have to support strenuous global warming legislation if they are going to come back to the voters in 2 years or 6 years.
The Jeffords and Waxman bills call for significantly bigger reductions of global warming gases than the only other significant such legislation that's been introduced in Congress, which is the McCain-Lieberman bill. Jeffords, the Vermont senator who famously switched from Republican to independent several years ago, he included in his bill a reduction in greenhouse gas emissions to 1990 levels by 2020. And the bill also calls for the U.S. To get 20% of its electricity from renewable sources by 2020, whereas now it's just a few percent that comes from renewables. Where does the legislation stand right now? I understand it was introduced in July.
The Jeffords bill, like all bills, will expire with this Congress. But yesterday, Bernie Sanders, the odds-on favorite to be our next senator, promised that his first act on his first day in the Senate would be to introduce the Jeffords bill again. That drew a large roar from the crowd.
Bill McKibben, you and a group of a lot of young people, I understand, people of all ages, walked for 5 days through Vermont, starting in Ripton, which is a little town up in the mountains, and ending in Burlington, the state's largest city. You started with a couple hundred people and ended with 1,000 at the rally on Lake Champlain. Paint us an audio picture of this walk, of this journey.
We started from Robert Frost's writing cabin there, and we walked down onto the broad Champlain Valley, dropped 1,000 feet that first day down onto the agricultural valley of bordering Lake Champlain, where we spent the next 4 days, some of it on back roads through old apple orchards and past pastures full of cows and horses, much of it on the main, albeit two-lane road on the west side of Vermont, Route 7, where we had the pleasure of seeing 80 or 85% of the cars that went by cheering and honking and waving and all of that. And by yesterday, we reached the one big city, such as it is in Vermont, Burlington, a city of about 40,000 people, and came on in through the kind of ring of car dealerships and fast food franchises on the edge of town, down to the main street and the waterfront of Lake Champlain to our backs. And there we had the largest political rally on any topic in Vermont in a very long time, and certainly the largest demonstration about global warming that yet took place in this country. And we felt mission accomplished by the time we were through.
I'm sure most people in this country still think of Vermont as a picture postcard state with lots of cows, brilliant fall foliage, pure white snow in the winter, and maple sugaring in the early spring. But your website provides some data that show things have changed a lot already, and not for the good.
Last year we had a very soggy, bleak, rainy, muddy winter. You know, our maple sugar season barely came. It means that we had record rains all spring. Now we're having, you know, to try to figure out some way to bail out all the dairy farmers who couldn't get their corn crop in to feed their cows over this coming winter. On and on and on. You know, even in a place as small as Vermont, we can see the changes. And, of course, the changes we're seeing are nothing compared to those at the top of the world in the Arctic or in those places where people are most vulnerable and marginal, along low-lying coastal areas in the tropics, things like that.
This has been a big week for the fight against global warming. Your walk has raised awareness at the grassroots level. And in California, the legislature just passed and Governor Schwarzenegger signed a bill to significantly reduce levels of carbon dioxide emissions, that being the biggest contributor to global warming. You said that this was the most hopeful you felt in years.
That's very good news that California has taken a legislative lead on this. What it demonstrates really is that we need federal action to to allow all the other states to really do their thing. We've done our work, in some of it anyway, in state houses and city halls. We haven't been able to break through in Washington. Much will depend on this year's election, and much will depend on what we do with whatever Congress comes after that. We need people out in the streets.
That was author and activist Bill McKibben. For more information on Vermonters walking toward a clean energy future, visit the group's website at www.vtw-alc.org. Labor Day 2006 saw more grim evidence of a decline in the standard of living for American workers. The U.S. Census reported in late August that median hourly wages, adjusted for inflation, have declined by 2% since 2003, while productivity and corporate profits have risen. According to press reports, wages and salaries now make up the lowest share of the nation's gross domestic product since the government began keeping records in 1947. In contrast, corporate profits have climbed to their highest level since the 1960s. Underscoring the new economic data, a new report by the groups United for a Fair Economy and the Institute for Policy Studies, titled Executive Excess 2006, documents how defense and oil industry CEOs have seen their compensation skyrocket. Authors of the report assert that top executives in these industries have personally benefited from U.S. wars and rising oil prices. Top corporate executives in the U.S. earn considerably more than their European and Asian counterparts. Between the Lines, Scott Harris spoke with Sarah Anderson, a fellow at the Institute for Policy Studies and co-author of the report, who explains the relationship between U.S. wars in Iraq and Afghanistan and the exponential increase in executive pay.
We've been doing this study now for 13 years, and every year we have some statistics that we update regularly, and those include information about the growing gap between what CEOs make and what workers make. This year, that gap stood at 411-1. And this year, the report focuses on executives in the defense industry and also the oil industry, because we thought it would be important at this time with the rising costs of the war to look at who might be benefiting from global conflict. And I think our report shows that executives in both of these industries have been cashing in on conflict.
Give us some examples of the huge numbers that we're talking about when it comes to CEO pay in these particular industries and how they've risen exponentially in recent years.
Mm-hmm. Well, the really eye-popping figures are in the pay packages of the oil CEOs. And we looked at the top 15 U.S. oil executives and found that they made on average $32.7 million. And that was up 50% from the year before. And so at a time when, you know, the average American is really feeling the pinch when they're filling up their tank at the gas station, it's a little troubling, I think, to find that the executives at the top of the oil industry have been really profiting, I would say grotesquely, off of the rising price of global oil prices.
Go into some examples, if you would, from the defense industry as well.
Yes. Well, here I think you have probably the most direct link with the war on terror and who's benefiting. We looked at the top executives at the top 34 U.S. defense contractors and found that their pay since September 11th has been about double what it was during the years leading up to September 11th. And so, for example, the highest paid defense executive has been George David at United Technologies, which makes, you may know, Black Hawk helicopters and fighter jet engines. And he has made personally more than $200 million since September 11th.
How do you distinguish between legitimate profits made on commodities the nation needs versus war profiteering? In other words, maybe you could define war profiteering for us.
Yeah, well, I think there are different definitions of it. And when I talk about it, I'm just talking about people making very high personal profits off of war. And, you know, I'm not saying that people shouldn't get a decent reward for a job well done. And certainly some of these companies are providing valuable services. But I find it unseemly for people to rush to cash in massive stock options packages that have increased in value largely due to a war in which thousands of people are dying. And I think that we need to bring back the sentiment in this country that there is something wrong with making these kinds of excessive personal gains on the backs of other people suffering. I've looked a lot into the history around this, and especially in World War II, where you had a president, Franklin Roosevelt, saying he didn't want to see a single millionaire created out of that tragedy. And you had a real crusade to prevent any kind of personal aggrandizement out of World War II. It wasn't a perfect system, but they were a lot more concerned about it than people are today. And I think we should be even more concerned about it today, because this is the most privatized war in history. More private companies are doing more jobs that the military sometimes even used to do themselves, you know, things like feeding the troops, providing their health care, training interrogators, and so forth. I think we need to have a closer eye on what's going on with all this money. We don't call for a fixed cap on CEO pay, but one thing that I think we should be doing at a minimum is making sure that taxpayers are not subsidizing these excessively high levels of pay. And there has been a bill introduced in Congress that would do that. This bill would say that companies could pay their CEOs whatever they would like, but they won't be able to deduct excessive amounts of pay from their corporate income taxes. And the standard that's in this bill is that they wouldn't be able to deduct anything above 25 times what the lowest paid worker makes. And so it would be an incentive to narrow the gap in pay within corporations without putting an absolute ceiling on what the CEOs could make. And I think that would at least be a very good start in reducing the incentives that are out there now for this runaway pay.
That was Sarah Anderson, a fellow at the Institute for Policy Studies and a co-author of the report Executive Excess 2006, Defense and Oil Executives Cash In on Conflict. Read a copy of the report by visiting the Institute's website at www.ips-dc.org. You've been listening to Between the Lines, a weekly program presenting news and analysis of critical issues affecting our region, the nation, and the world. Between the Lines is produced at the studios of WPKN Radio and distributed by Squeaky Wheel Productions. If you have suggestions for topics and guests, please contact Between the Lines by calling area code 203-331-9756 or write to Between the Lines, care of WPKN Radio, 244 University Avenue, Bridgeport, Connecticut, 06604. Visit our website at www.btlonline to hear our current and archived programs in MP3 and real audio. There you can subscribe to free weekly podcasts, program summaries, and interview transcripts. Our theme music was written by Richard Hill and Jody Gray and performed by Mika Ta. This week's program is produced by Scott Harris, with the assistance of Bill Cosentino, Chris Ferriero, Hank Hoffman, Anna Manzo, Bob Nixon, Melinda Tuhus, and Jeff Yates. For Between the Lines, I'm Denise Manzari.